Adam's account of the sinking of the Hazel.
I've waited almost 6 years for compensation of this case. Looks like it's getting close. Before it does, I'll make a volunteer. What actually happened to me that night on the 27th of March 1980. The Keeland, which is a five-leg drilling rig, had been converted by putting metal boxes on the drill deck and used as accommodation. She was positioned alongside the other platform in the Norwegian sector of the North Sea at about 250 feet of water. She's attached to the other by a bridge which is approximately 200 feet long. Not only the people that worked on the construction of the other, but also people from other platforms in the vicinity within a few miles lived on the Keeland as well, and they would shuttle to work every day. Unfortunately, because of the bad weather, they overcast that day. The shuttle helicopters didn't fly these men to work. Consequently, the time it happened, there was more people on the board than what would normally be expected to be on, and there was 212 people on board. Now, the weather had been terrible there. The rain was coming down horizontally. It had been a force eight, it was freezing cold, the sea was very choppy, and it started to get worse as it was nearing tea time, and knocking off time, which is 6 o'clock. At about 20 minutes to six, I was in the office, and our radio operator took a message from the Keeland to say that they were going to lift the bridge. They normally do this in bad weather, and the rig pulls off away from the platform in case of any damage. She pulls off about 100 yards. Because I heard the message earlier, I dashed across, threw me coat into the cabin and went down for my dinner. As I came back on the deck and saw everybody running across the bridge, this was about 5:45. Before I go any further, what I would like to do is tell you about some of my friends who had worked with for more than another year and a half that were on there. First, there was John Murray. He was my roommate, electrical supervisor. He'd just arrived back from Mallorca. In fact, he brought some pamphlets for me. There was John Richardson. He was the general foreman. I'd worked with him before on shore jobs. He unfortunately had an accident on a previous, well, years ago, when his arms was being badly hurt. There was George Collins, piping foreman from Newcastle, another good friend. He brought some material on board to make suit material, which I was going to look at after this anyway. P.J. Pender, welding foreman. Living in Derby, he was an Irishman living in Derby. He was going to have a look at the cloth as well. And it was John Phillips, the clerk, timekeeper. He was very unfortunate, and as much as he was late getting on the platform, he missed it, missed the flight. And he made his own way via Aberdeen, Stavanger, met Phil Case, the Phillips superintendent, who used his influence and got him on the only helicopter that landed them there. There was Dave Elliott. He travelled with me, Pinker, from Gateshead. He also, well, actually, had brought some leek seeds for one of the men, and he told John McGrady, who was the foreman rigger. I was passing the pump room, and I met John McGrady with Keith Hunter and Colin Lamb, the other two riggers, and they persuaded me to give them some leek seeds, which I said I'd give after the summer again when we met back that night. There was Brian Graham, the same man as myself, the former Finner. He'd just been phoning his wife, or actually was phoning his wife, as the accident happened. There was Michael Fleming, Mick Fleming, sat beside him in the cinema. He'd had a part share in a horse and would be kidding about it just before the film started. There was John Harris, He was an electrical supervisor. He was sat in the back row, sat with the, and the light fessers. That was trying to get extracted. Then there was John Aiden and Barry Pickup. John Aiden and Terry Lester, they both managed to get out and managed to get all the life vest. There's Barry Pickup, he didn't normally go to the cinema. He was very useful. He used to make, he was the lagging foreman and sheet metal worker. He used to make belt buckles for everybody, so he was very popular. There was Rod Jackson, he was the Phillips rep. Mechanical engineer who I worked with closely. In fact, when we went into the cinema, he was sat up with an empty chair next to him, and I asked him if he could, if I could sit there, and he said, unfortunately, Rolf Remy, who's a material man with Phillips, he, it was his seat, he'd go for coffee. We were just sat down for the film, which was Jeremiah Johnson, Robert Redford. Keith Hunter was the operator. In fact, the cinema is not what people expect, a proper cinema. It was a part of the drill deck down below where all the stores were kept, heavy equipment, and they'd use corrugated sheets to partition part of it off and put a screen up at the other end. Lights gone out was pretty full as well. There was about 70 in. Lights went out. The film was running about 10 minutes, 5-10 minutes. When there was this loud crack. So you're used to hearing unusual noises all day long, but then this was different. And Mabel Fleming next to me said that sounded like an anchor came or come. And instinctively he moved downward. We were third row from the back. We turned round into the aisle and the back three rows had done the same thing. And there was a bit congestion at the door. By the time I got to the door, someone had dragged a seat, a chair, and it was wedged across the doorway. My chest was on it, and I was being pushed and pressed by all the people behind. I shouted to try and ease back. There was a slight easing back, and I managed to throw the chair out the door. While I was waiting for them to ease back, I could see the lights outside, and the siren started to go, the abandoned ship. As the chair went, everyone pushed me. There was a large coil of wire rope in front. I was catapulted into that and fell bottom first into it with my legs hanging over the metal wire. Everyone was falling on me. My legs were going to be broken. Shouted and asked them to ease up. Eventually the din, there was many people that poured out the cinema with it, along the decks to try and find a companionway so that they could climb up onto the main deck. All manner of things started to slide now. The deck was probably about 20 degrees. Washing machines under there, big pieces of heavy equipment. It was frightening. Eventually, I made my way along to a bulkhead where there was a ladder or stairway up onto the main deck. But this was solid with people. There was no way I could have gotten out there in a hurry anyway. It was just solid. So I decided I'd move past the mudroom to another set of stairs. As I was about to pass the mudroom, there was this terrible metal-to-metal crunching. In actual fact, it must have been the blowout preventer snapping in the moon pool. Then there was a large amount of timber that had been stored in the deck. That came flying by. And even though it was only a few strides to this doorway, it's difficult to understand when you're on the level how you could not move just a few strides. But when the deck's on an angle, you're all under balance and trying to grab things was difficult. But anyway, I mentioned eventually I made it. When I got through there, I could see the water from the deck below was right above the stairways. On this stair, leading up under the main deck, was two people. It was a Norwegian and a friend of mine, John Richardson. John said, I'm sorry, Bill, you can't go up onto the main deck because everything's lashing about. There was big containers, there was scrap skips. Just then, something came into contact with the little housing that was at the top of the stairs and closed the doors. Where we were standing on the bottom of the stairs, I realised that the water from down below was up to my knees. And even though I knew there was something serious going on, it was difficult to understand, try and sort your mind out. The one thing I did do was say a prayer. I realised that something serious was happening. This could be it. After a few minutes, the door was flung open onto the deck and the Norwegian went out. John went down, I was the last one. It was only then that it hit me. When I saw the sea literally feet away and one of the legs was still attached to the deck, horizontal on the water. I then made a quick decision. I decided, should I dive into the water and swim to this leg and hang on to it? Or should I cling and try and get as high as I could? Keep trying. Possibility of it not sinking, it might just float. Anyway, I decided the latter. I got round the housing and I don't know when the Norwegian had come. But I said to John, come on, let's climb. And he said, I'm sorry, Bill, but the accident I had, the arms were bent. He could still grip things, but his arms had a kink in them. He said, I'm not going to make it, you go ahead. So what I did was I climbed up to a hose station, a fire hose station, and run the fire hose down for him to get hold of. Then I climbed a bit further to the middle of what was the heli deck. He climbed up that far and then I got hold of his hand and dragged him a bit further. Then I paused for thought because I heard a helicopter above. And when I looked up, right enough, there was a Sikorsky overhead. But the deck was at an angle of probably 45 degrees now. There's no way it could land. I thought, shall I hang on to the netting on the deck? Or, I don't know. But there's lots of things. Quickly, go through your mind. So I decided to go towards the housing and the metal housing around the drill floor. On the bulkheads, they had 1.5 inch angle bar, a stiffness. So I made for that. Crawl unders, which in large bottles, probably the black start of the drilling equipment. So crawl under there to this bulkhead and used the stiffness on the bulkhead as ladders, which got me near to the top of the, as high as I could go. I then managed to climb over other equipment, leapfrog from this to that, till eventually I got behind the drill rig housing. Those men had been crawling up one of the legs to a lifeboat and running back. There was men running all over the place. By now it was probably past 45 degrees. Everybody was trying to get a dry place, a high place. And I'd more or less reached the point of no return. I couldn't go any higher. There was nothing to go. So I stopped there to gather my thoughts. So one of your friends, Colin Lamb, on the top of a metal or cement sail, shouting if I could reach him. I couldn't reach him. There was nothing I could pass over to him to bring him over towards me. As it happened, he couldn't swim or from anywhere. Anyway, I looked to the left and I could see the header platform. I could see the crane dropping a basket, picking out of the water. I could see containers. In fact, I saw one wash over somebody and go at that. It was later. People told me that had been watching that there was an alleyway between the other side of the drill rig, where there was an alleyway between the accommodation and the drill cook and the drill rig, that people were trying to climb up. The majority from the cinema were trying to climb up there, but everything was sliding down there. There was containers with scaffolding. There was oxygen and acetylene bottles stacked there. There was rigging stacked there. In fact, someone saw an oxygen bottle take a man's hour. Someone resting in the round against the door came and just took it off. All this was going on and on. From above me, there was a cradle with a crane in. I started to worry, think, is this going to come to top of me? I also was behind the drill rig. Looking at the derrick, I was hoping that the derrick would snuff and maybe take some of the weight off, so to flip it come back. Anyway, I thought this is it. So I'll trip, just go through your mind. I said, this is it. So I said a prayer. I made an act of contrition and tried to set myself in on it. And all of a sudden, there was, it plunged. What had happened was the back end, as I said, there was this white foam just came through the deck. Just a white wall, it'd be. Then I was aware of Carlo, me, and me. The roar and everything that was going on, it was silenced. So I came to a sudden halt. Something metal that hit me in the back. I was afraid it was a metal container, possibly squashed me out. I didn't want to be squashed. Near the top of my drawing, I didn't want to be squashed. Then I realized I was wearing that. And I thought we found me, Catherine and Claire. She was several at the time. How are they going to manage without me? So I've got to fight beneath me. I swore, till I broke surface. And one more sooner, I had grabbed some air. Then it had turned over, I presume. And down it went again. I was underneath it and out. Pining like hell. And we loaded were bursting, actually. And I was blowing air out, hoping that I didn't want to take it in, I just kept blowing out, till eventually I did break surface a second time. There were 40-gallon drill popped up in front of me. This is what happens in the world, you said, but you know, no way can you get hold of one. It just bobbed away. Of course, the seas were high, 20-foot waves. I spotted an upturned light bulb between me and the other platform. And I thought, that's it, you've got to do that. When I saw a life vest, I didn't know where I was. Tried to get that, and it disappeared. I managed, as I was swimming, I felt somebody's thermal jacket under the water, so it was to me, a body just below me. So the only thing left was for me was this upturned life form, which I swam, and believe me, when you think you're exhausted and you're just about finished, I was asking for me, will it help me? Eventually, I grabbed hold of somebody, and the terror on his face where he saw me, I leaped over him. The first contact was this man's shoulder, and he felt I was pulling him in. There was a lanyard hanging from the silver light bulb, which I leaped over and grabbed hold of. But once I got hold of something and felt I could keep my head over the water, oh, it was wonderful. I thought, you've got to make it now. Anyway, what had happened was there was eight men, approximately. It had gone down with this up to the left. And they were inside. They started to walk around from side to side, and there was lots of people hanging on these lanyards all the way around this up to the lake. And it was going one way, then it was going the other. One of these times, I didn't realise, but there was a little metal strip holding the lanyard onto the lifeboat. And that my full weight has gone up, it's been hanging on that, but almost cut the end of my index finger.
You don't feel anything in the index.
I would. But eventually it came over, and it came over beyond the head, but not beyond the lead. I swam to the top again, and it was rocking again. I hit my head second time underneath. The third time I was Simon Lightfoot. I grabbed hold of the lanyard again and pulled on. The safe were opened and we started to mend them in, we started to pull people inside. While I was holding on, I remember seeing bodies in the water. The hand light jacket on me crossed them up same time. And I thought, why don't they help myself? Why don't they come over here or try to come over here? All sorts went through me. Eventually, I was the last one in my side and put one arm inside. He was trying to pull me in, but I couldn't get it. I tried to get my leg in the lanyards to pull me something. No way. I thought, you made it. You come this far, you've got to make it. Until one of the men leaned out and grabbed hold of my belt and lifted me. Threw me head first, rained the bottle in the water. Then I realised it had to. He said, sit on the side, which I did. Then the brain was telling me, get yourself moving. I didn't realise how cold I must have been. I don't know, I'd be in the water maybe 10 minutes or so. No. I could not even clap my hands. I was that stiff. But eventually I did. Clap my hands. Swung my elbows. Awake eye. Hit an egg falling. Until I could move. Now it was bitterly cold. Then, we sat at the bottom of the boat. Across the middle to try and keep it stabilized. It was bouncing about, drumming glass fiber, and we were bouncing all over the place. After some time, a supply boat came on side. Threw a scramble net over, and I think four men leaped across. I presume they were dry because I was too stiff and cold to do anything. There was no way I was stuck there for 2 weeks. No, I was safe off that scene. He threw a plastic bag in and there was three blankets in. Passed one blanket over to Tommy Greenwood. I could see he had a broken hand. I gave one to somebody on the side of each of the lad who had a panic of head. And the third one, I put across the shoulders and a Norwegian boy sat next to me. Who was in a complete daze. I was talking to him and he just wouldn't respond. He was in complete shock. Eventually, next to me came the radio operator from the Keeling, who asked if he could sit next to me. So the three of us shared this blanket across our shoulders. He just had a shirt on with no shoes or socks. And tried hitting each other on the thighs to try and get the circulation going and get some more going. In fact, the radio opera from the Keeling did a very good job, but as much as the radio wouldn't work at first, the diesel line on the lifeboat had broken. We didn't use the lights, but we could use the battery, which we did, to get light, but we only used it on occasions when the radio needed to be awakened. So we sat the dog on it. The radio operator eventually got the machine going and gave the location because he didn't know where we were. He gave the status of everybody in there to say how many there were and how bad the injuries were, and the reply was that fair enough would fuck you. On radar, we know where you are, and there's more urgent cases of people floating about in the water which we're waiting for, and we'll come for you eventually, which was the correct thing to do. By Joe, it was a Monday. Part of the call, we trying to switch off mentally. I was trying to think of things
in Sikugam in Kalvatir's anything. So a few seconds and then whoosh, that being wave hit me again. And again. After a few hours, I could hear helicopters of Tom. I knew it was just a matter of time. And a Bell's helicopter, which only carries 12 people, flew all the top and through a plastic sledge, or probably a stretcher. Honestly, it kept bouncing across the top of the housing. And four managed to climb up into that, which was very precarious because of the way we were bouncing in the water. So the rest settled down. I'm alone, mate. And eventually it did come. Helicopter did arrive and people started getting out. Of course, I was sat there without a stiff as a board, without a life vest. Someone at the front did manage to find one, but as they pulled it, they took half the straps away, so I had a life vest with half a strap on. I crawled along the top and found on the deck, it was a nice starry night, and the wind had gone down a fair bit. Still walking along, but the wind had gone down even. A man in a red suit. He was one of the helicopter men. It was the Norwegian Army, I think. It killed a Sea King helicopter. He had two straps. One of the lads got in the strap, and I sat in it, but didn't sit in it. I was sat my bottom in it, really. He gave me a punch, and my brain was numb. And he indicated under the arms, which of course I did then, and then once in the anchor, and I was swinging in midair. The fact that we felt as though your back was broken. And eventually we got into the helicopter, and then you felt the warmth when the blood started to come through in the extremities, it started to tingle and shiver and shake. But hear me. This was about 5:30 at night, 5:30 in the morning. So we'd been in that boat for another 11 hours. Eventually, when they picked up the rest of us, they took us to the Echo Fist Hotel. Lots of people willing hands there to help us, get us from the helicopter, get us downstairs. They had temporary beds or mattresses, whatever they could. And they stripped everybody up, all your clothes off, give you a blanket, and you rested there while they took all of the names. They did an oil crawl. Well, unfortunately, there was another Graham on board, Brian Graham. My name's William, but I go by Bill. So I only call myself William. The tragedy is that Brian made. After they did a quick examination, they gave us a pair of thermal overalls. There was a few socks, some wet socks, some lint. And they asked us if we would like to go down to the canteen, get a meal. Helicopter wouldn't be long in coming, which it wasn't. And they took us all to Stavanger, to the military hangar in Sola Airport, Stavanger, where they checked everybody out. Some for hospital, some for hotel. Well, I asked for the hospital because I looked, your finger was hanging up, and I had these terrible pains in my back. And I felt it would probably be the right thing to do to get a checkup anyway before I went in any hotel. So they sent me to a hospital, and I was complaining about my stomach because we'd been retching through the night. When they took the overalls off me, I could tell by their faces I must have been bad. In the sort of state of anywhere, they took me into the intensive care ward. I put the heart machine over there, checked the kidneys, and I was suffering from hypothermia, plus bruises, which I was bruised from it, but. And I was in there for 5 days. They checked the kidneys, and they said I had a failure in the kidneys, probably due to the hypothermia. But even though I was going through an awful lot of hardship and suffering, also my family, because my wife knew about 8 o'clock at night there was a news flash on the television. She realised that where it was, that must have been the semi-sub that I was on. But fortunately, my sister doesn't. Hello, I was talking about my family suffering, and they did, because my two sisters came around and stayed with my wife, and all night they kept taking phone calls from the company. At one period they said I was alive, then later on they said, sorry, but that was wrong information. And it was 7 o'clock in the morning before they found out that I was really alive. Now, when I landed in Norway, a friend of mine was there from the company. I asked him to phone the wife. He did, and he said I'd walked off and that it was all right. When they got me in the hospital, they realized how bad I was. They put me in the intensive care unit, and a priest came in, an American Baptist priest, asked me how I was and could he phone my wife. I said, oh, it's all right. Anyway, he took the telephone number, phoned the wife, and said I was in the intensive care. Well, you can imagine the state she was in. A friend of mine saying I was all right, and this priest saying I was in the intensive care. Fortunately, the television cameras came in and asked if they could speak to me. And the doctor allowed them to do so. And lo and behold, I came on the television on the news that evening. So my wife had spent 2 days up and down with different types of information. It wasn't until 6 o'clock the following evening that she found out or saw me on television. So it was a very traumatic time for them. Traumatic. They kept me in for 5 days, kidney tests, checks, then they sent me home. I was very tired when I got home. Before that, I was just still being the adrenaline working, but when I got home, it was just like a balloon that had burst. Maybe after about 5 weeks or 4 weeks, I got a telephone call from the platform, superintendent asking if I was coming back. If I wasn't, when would I be? Because he had a replacement lined up. And I thought, my God, not only have you gone through this traumatic experience, you've lost your job as well. So after 5 weeks, I went back. Trying to put a brave face on it, mentally it was terrible. There were so many reminders, or my notes to see people. Out of the 16 UK construction men left on the other platform that night, there was only 3 of us near it. Foreman Ringer, Teddy Lister, Foreman Instruments, John Ed, and myself. All the rest went. In fact, with the subcontractors our company employed, we lost 50. And out of it, total loss was 123 people. There was 123 families involved as well. The memories there, I used to look out of the window of my office and see the salvage vessels picking up plates and pieces of equipment from the seabed. Because an awful lot had fallen off the keel when she overturned. There was one night when a storm came up. I was so terrified because the accommodation was on a catalina. I couldn't sleep. I was even going to put a survival suit on and lie in the fire pump room because it was on the main platform. And it took me 3 o'clock before I dozed over. It was a terrible fight. Then you start thinking about some of the things that had happened previously which I could ignore, such as the bridge had fallen off a few times. The strain that was put on me, Keelan, or any semi-sub, just to keep men at work so they didn't have to shuttle them across, where those legs are a terrible strain, trying to hold it in station, maybe in a force 8. There's times when Phillips would come and ask us there's a good boss of labour to go over and do jobs on there, such as the crane pedestal was cracked. If it hadn't been spotted, then the crane could have gone over. It may have had the bridge out at the same time. Lots of various things like that. And which made me right after jobs. Any short job, I just had to get away. I used to like fishing. I couldn't go fishing there, and then it was terrible. Anyway, the company I was working for had a job in Verdal, which is in Norway, up near the Arctic Circle. There were some modules being there, which were for the Valhalla platform. They asked me if I would go and supervise that and eventually take it off as project engineer, which was an increase, a promotion for me, because I was only class mechanical engineer. I jumped at anything just to get on shore. Now, after I'd been up to Verdal, I came back to the Stirling office, and the accommodation I was living in, I had to pass every day the four legs of the keel, which was submerged, and I had to pass it every day to go on. And you start thinking of things. I decided that there was no way I could go back. And of course, the delay in riding the Alexander Keeland, they just kept my money down high all the time. So when I told my company that I couldn't go back off, they weren't very pleased and sent me back to the UK, to the Aberdeen office. Then they sent me a lower position to Great Yarmouth. And in all fairness to them, if I'm no good, if I could not go offshore, I wasn't a great deal of good to an offshore company. They could not find me continuous work and so forth. So they worked me out to such a state that I applied for a job or whether it's to get one at work in the Middle East. And while I went for this medical, I saw my doctor and he said, your blood pressure's high, which I'd never been troubled with before. But I told him the next day I was going to Harley Street to meet Philip's psychiatrist. So he said, well, maybe that's a misstatement. So I went back a week or two later and it was normal. But after 6 years, the same things happened again. It was studied down. And recently I've been getting letters about my claim will be terminated and my blood pressure's high again, and it's got to be attributed to all this delay that this case is taking. In fact, I've been informed that if the case is not settled between Phillips and Stavanger Court, if it's not settled between me and Phillips, then the Stavanger Court will settle it. So even though the case had gone to the United States, and I would get nothing if it was never heard. I'm just going to have to settle in Stavanger, one way or another, whether it be out of court or in the court deciding that this is tracked. It's not bad dreams, I mean. Either against Phillips, because it will repeat the sort of worsty dreams I've formed, and they'll then just come into it and on something. You know, I really feel that Sariat, I wish it was all along. What they've done to me. Like now, I can't go offshore, be offered lots of jobs because I'm quite well known in the business. And in fact, could win the job up on now. They've been asking me. I've been doing the job on the show, number one, can you take it offshore? So I'm sorry, but I can't. I've only got some offer, actually, to go offshore. But I'm only operating as an engineer now, whereas my job opportunities would have been much better if I had gone out in the Valhalla as project engineer. And all come about because of this accident. And really, I'm disgusted at the way I feel I've been trapped by Finch. The off those £2,000 to the first instance was a joke. Well, it was a cruel joke. Because the clause and loss of earnings for the first few weeks came to £1,500. And offering me virtually £1,000 for the pain and suffering to me thoroughly, that was disgraceful. After seeing psychiatrists, doctors about anger. They did eventually increase the claim. But it came to a state where the case was going to be heard at the market. Now, one of the reasons for the was prepared to go to America was that over there, the claims they, one of the claims they have, they said, punitive damages. Punitive damages meaning that no company or large corporation can ride roughshod over the ordinary man or someone smaller. I would like to think that those 123 men didn't die in vain, and that if the company, in this case Phillips, were taught a lesson by a large fine, then other companies, other corporations, might spend a lot more money on the safety side, and if one life can be saved, whether it be offshore, onshore, any industry at all, I feel that the case will have been justified by going there. Even though there is a financial gain effect, for me, that was not my main aim. And whether that's ever going to be heard in the States or not. But present, I'm in a state where my health is suffering too much, and I would like to see it closed. So it's possibly that we are.
That's the stuff.